Support for KMUW's Into Music podcast comes from McClelland, reminding listeners that Frank Sinatra coined the word skibbity in Strangers in the Night, which you can listen to in their downtown Wichita showroom. More info on McClelland's innovative sound, lighting, and video technology can be found at maxsound.com.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guests on this episode are Greg Saunier and Kurt Sidner of Bach Artillery. The duo has just released its self-titled debut album, which is described as an absurdist take on the nine canons from Johann Sebastian Bach's Goldberg Variations and his Brandenburg Concerto No. 5. While the canons are arranged for live synthesizers and drums, the concerto movements are rendered employing MIDI technology. The two musicians have collaborated on past recordings, and Sidner adds that while both have conservatory studies behind them, they were eager to demonstrate that classical music is not above bold reinterpretation. The pair recently spoke about the possibilities for reinterpretations of classical works, how different performance configurations for Bach Artillery might create even more musical variations, and Saunier's observations about Miloš Forman's 1984 adaptation of Peter Schaffer's play Amadeus. A quick note to listeners that Sidner is occasionally absent from the conversation as he was at an urgent care clinic attending to a minor medical problem. That's Greg Saunier and Kurt Sidner of Bach Artillery on Into Music coming up now. Can you just sort of tell me when and where this idea occurred to you to make this record?
The impetus to play this music came from a holiday market gig where I needed some classical sounding repertoire, and I had these canons that I've been practicing, and I started playing them with percussion, and immediately had a vision of doing these as a suite with Greg pretty immediately. And it just took years to come to fruition. And then we met one day last year and did it.
That's true. We have been talking about this literally for years. I mean, you had this.
Yeah.
You know, every time you tell the holiday market story, I keep thinking it was, you know, it was holidays 2024 or 25. But no, it was like, this was like 100 years ago or something.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I just happened to be practicing then.
We were both playing on Big Ears Festival in Knoxville last March, 1 year ago. And, you know, by chance. And so we're like, let's stay one extra day in Knoxville. I have a friend, Jake, who has a studio in his house, and we just record there. And so we just did it. And it was very spur of the moment. I mean, it was spur of the moment for me. It was not spur of the moment for Kurt, who'd been practicing, you know, this rather difficult contrapuntal keyboard music for years.
Yeah. The keyboard, it's the whole concept is designed where the keyboard part is playing all the Bach music verbatim and leaving space for the drums to interact and be spontaneous. There's not much spontaneity. I've tried to engineer some moments where spontaneity can be possible for the keyboardist, but most of the spontaneity resides in the drum part or the drum approach.
Would you
agree with that?
About you know, the nature of you know, Western classical notated music, and particularly music of that era, where, you know, it's not like Bach gives a metronome marking, you know, and although there were decades in which, you know, 20th century performers of Bach were just convinced that Bach's music was always meant to be played in the most mechanical way possible, where you might as well have gotten a machine to play it, and then it would be perfect. You know, in in more recent decades, you know, people have started taking all kinds of approaches. And one of the obvious ones is has to do with tempo and has to do with the rhythmic feel. So it's like, Kurt, you can be playing the notes verbatim off the page, but that doesn't mean that we aren't also speeding up and slowing down, you know, spontaneously. There's still a lot of
room. Oh, yeah. That's right. Yeah, there is plenty of flexibility in the way that we, you know, that's good classical playing too. Is you know, you could be a classical performer and adhering very rigidly but adhering to the score as expected, and have performances differ greatly.
Absolutely.
Based on a kind of improvisation that occurs when the performer is truly in the moment, whether they're like truly improvising or playing music that they've rehearsed for hours and hours. If you're in the moment, likely going to be different from the time you played it before, and thus spontaneous.
Well, I think it's interesting because I think about the time that the two of you were recording this, I was in Nashville, and I came across the recordings of Glenn Gould playing this music, and he does those two different versions, right? Like one from 59 and one from 81 or
early
something.
In his career and one late in his career.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, speaks to some of what you're talking about, just the differences that can occur over time with that, you know, with just certain pieces of music.
That's Glenn Gould. I mean, that's just one guy. I mean, you know,
right.
And you know, think of, even if you just take Goldberg Variations, which is, you know, what we're excerpting on our record, you know, I mean, the range is already large just within one dude, you know, Glenn Gould. But think of, you know, it's like, Gould is playing it on piano, an instrument that hadn't even been invented yet when J.S. Bach was writing the piece, you know, that you can find versions of the piece on harpsichord or on organ. You can find arrangements for string trio. You can, you know, I saw a concert once that was a string trio version. And Bach in particular, you know, not just Goldberg Variations, but, you know, so much of his output, you know, has probably been subjected to more transcriptions and, you know, reinterpretations than probably any composer in Western music history, you know.
Yeah, that's probably true.
About it that is sort of foolproof or just indestructible, you know,
yeah.
No matter if it's on synthesizers or Koto or, you know, voices or whatever, doing scat singing. I mean, it's the music still seems to land.
Well, he left fewer literal instructions as to how to play any right. given melodic line or dynamic. That was pretty much just the notes on the page.
Yeah, totally.
When you look at the Bach manuscripts and with later composers, of course, the instructions became a lot more specific as the notion of composition evolved into a more romantic idea of artistic expression rather than a kind of artisanal. I don't know, Greg, would you say artisanal about
the way I think of it is something? No, it's something more than an artisanal because both and artisanal still imply that what you get at the end is a product, you know. It's sort of like what they say about content, you know. It's something that's for sale at the end that then you can post on Instagram or something.
Yeah,
I think that notation is designed almost in a pedagogical, is even too limiting. I feel that what he's doing is a provocation to the player to discover what the piece means. It's a process of discovery. So for example, you know, and it's true of many of the pieces that we're playing, you know, on this record, you know, on the score, you just see an unbroken series of 16th notes, but that doesn't mean that there are no phrases. Now, so just Bach doesn't put a line over where the phrases begin and end, or put it like a little breath mark between where he wants the phrases to one phrase to end and the next to begin. Doesn't mean that there are no possible phrases within these 16th notes, and it's up to the performer to discover through their own analysis or performance of the piece to discover what the piece is. And they may come up with a solution that is exactly what Bach had in mind, or they may come up with a different solution. And every player will do it differently. You know, I'm the kind of person, I mean, like, I played Bach a lot when I was taking piano lessons when I was younger, and my tendency was to chop it up into a lot of really small phrases, you know, like these three notes, and then I would do like a little like awkward gap and then start the next four notes, and I was much less of like a flowing kind of pianist. What that process of me deciding where I think the phrases belong was for me becoming the collaborator, the co-composer, in a sense, you know, of the musical experience, you know, once it's happening in real time, in real life, you know, in the 21st century or in the late 20th century, which was when I was taking the piano lessons. I think it's more than just an artisan. I think the piece isn't done. I think it's a bit of a Bach saying, well, here, what do you think of this? What do you make of this? What's your interpretation of this? And then you kind of have to give a response. And if you don't give a response, then the piece isn't really done, you know?
I love that because it's like theater, right? Like you can take a Greek play or Shakespeare and how many variations can you get on soliloquies and so forth, you know?
To be or not to be, for example. Exactly. Theater is a great example, and it's interesting because that's one in which, I mean, I'm not familiar with you know, the sort of theater industry the way I am with the music industry, but my sense is that openness to interpretation is a little bit more within the comfort zone and a little bit more welcomed within the theater tradition than it has become within the classical music tradition, in which interpretations have actually, ironically, kind of whittled down. I think it has a lot to do with records and recordings. A smaller and smaller number of war horses from the classical music repertoire are the ones that get recorded over and over and over again because the marketing team, you know, at corporate HQ has decided those are the ones that sell and they don't want to gamble on anything else. And then even as you've got, you know, the trillionth interpretation of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony or something like that, you'd think, well, at least that gives you a chance to do some radically different interpretations of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. But just the opposite has turned out to be true based on the evidence. And if you go back and listen to records, like if you listen to records from the early days of recording, from the early 20th century or even the late 19th century, you hear really wild, what to our ears sounds like incredibly wild performances, and that they've become much more streamlined over the years due to the competition between orchestras or between performers or conductors or pianists or whatever it is, and they have to be better than the record of the same piece that came out last year, you know, and they're trying to get a review that where they it's basically just a big competition, and it's siphoned the art of, I mean, to me, it's basically turned all Western classical music into a kind of competitive, you know, sort of top 40 in a way, you know, whereas so much of this music was not necessarily even meant for the concert hall at all. It wasn't meant for the public. I mean, you think of Goldberg Variations. I mean, maybe there were performances, but A lot of times it's just there's the score and you play it at home in your living room, you know? And it's something, you know, where if anything was meant to sell, it was the sheet music. And then people play it at home for themselves or for their family or for their friend or for like they invite 10 people over to their living room, their salon, you know, and they have a concert there. No big concert hall acoustics, no, you know, playing it in a church. It's just like for home use and kind of intimate. And I feel like that aspect of quote unquote classical music has been just deleted, you know, from the historical imagination. You know, everything has to be in a concert hall or a church now, and everything has to be in this kind of tempo, and there can be no wrong notes or nothing out of tune, or you know, everything's edited in Pro Tools to be perfect, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, it's like you know. The irony is that classical music, in its desperation to stay alive, is committing suicide, you know.
Hell yeah, Greg. All true.
But there is that thing, and I've talked with people recently about that, about how recorded music did take some of the individuality out. It also took some of the communal aspects out, I would dare say, that people not gathering necessarily to sit around the piano or bring instruments to each other's houses changed as that proliferated.
Exactly. You're the what was done as communal music making was replaced by recordings. It was like, oh, you know, it's been one of the hallmarks of the history of capitalism is to take a thing that's in common in communities and find a way to sort of do a sort of like low energy version, packaged version of that, that requires no effort from the consumer. And it's like, well, instead of you having to learn how to play this song on guitar for your sing along at your house, we'll just make a record of that song and you can just press a button and then just sit and listen to the song. And it's, yes, it's not as good, it's not as intimate, it's not as communal, it's not as fun, but it's like 70% as fun and it's less work for you. So, and then sort of and then as people become habituated to recordings, then the art of the sing-along is lost, you know. And then and it's like pulling teeth to try and like, you know, restart that sort of tradition or something. It's a funny thing. I mean, you see it across all fields of human endeavor, but it's just because all three of us are in the music world, that's where we see it the clearest, you know. But of course, it's true of transportation, it's true of food, it's true of visual art, it's true of dreams and storytelling versus, you know, books, printing press, and then films, and then TV, and then, you know, streaming, et cetera. It's just substitute, you know, creating marketable, monetizable products that will replace things that were natural and traditional that human beings always did since the beginning of the species, you know, and substitute something that can make money, which is kind of a simulacrum of the original instinct and is meant to replace it.
To counter all of that, we decided
Yeah.
to pair some Bach cannons with a drum set.
Exactly.
We're in the comfort of our own home, our own temporary home, doing what we want with the notes that were left to us.
And it feels like a privilege. It's great.
Yeah.
I'm so glad that you asked me, you know, to do it. And it's like, you know, if we had recorded those same pieces on a Tuesday instead of a Monday, they would have all come out totally different, you know.
Yeah,
And we
that's
have
right.
enough. That's the fun, you know. We're gonna have part two, you know, in 2 days here in LA. You know, we're playing
Yeah,
a record show here in
it could be a
LA.
lot different.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I'm glad we didn't give ourselves more time to
Yes.
conceptualize because just do it, just having to do it in the moment and make the spontaneous decisions really I think, well, it saved us a lot of time. And you get there's that maybe an urgency to the interpretations, a lack of or you know, without the additional forethought and conceptualizing.
Yeah, or
See,
self-limit.
there was that. I mean, I did the arrangements that I brought in, some of the introductions and interludes, clearly thought out in advance, and designed just as well as spaces for the musicians to stretch a little bit and
Loose.
and
Short.
frame the counterpoint in an exciting way.
Yeah, totally.
So that was thought out in advance. But then, yeah, just the feel of each one was very in the moment. And then in some cases, the actual interpretation, like, well, how should we do this one? Because only a few of them I had really planned out, and the rest I just kind of left up to whatever we would kind of decide based on what felt right, because God knows how it's going to feel. When you start, you can practice it for years and years, and then just
Sometimes the acoustics, or the whoever else is in the room listening, can really change what ends up happening. I mean, I mean, we're making it sound as though that's all just sort of random, but I mean, the fact is you have many years of professional experience as a jazz musician, and the jazz is the the sort of overarching genre that exists that revitalized the art of spontaneity, where at the very moment that Western classical notated music was losing it, and
That's
was
right.
turning its back upon it, upon those that ethos. And jazz was invented and became a language and a form and a tradition of its own, very flexible, but a kind of language and a kind of tradition that those who become literate at it and who practice it become very excited to take risks. And kind of the whole name of the game is to improvise and to test yourself in real time, in front of other human beings. And so I don't want to, I guess the point there is that we didn't just like invent the idea of spontaneity from nothing. I think in my case, I'm not a trained jazz musician, but I play improvisation a lot in my band Deerhoof and with other people and stuff. There is also a precedent, of course, that we're drawing on, that's influencing the way that we, are making this Bach thing sound.
And it's I don't want to, I hesitate to say anything nationalistic, or but the American approach to the arts of Europe has long been one that revitalizes the old forms, and it does it with or without permission.
I guess part of this too, right, is I think I read something, in the press release, and not to lean too heavily on that, but that struck me about this kind of demystification of classical music and the sense that it's not necessarily something that belongs, in an unreachable cage or something, that it really should be something for everybody.
I mean, regardless of whether it is something for everybody, I actually don't think that that particular language or tradition, any more than any other language or tradition, should be required for anybody. But I do very much agree with you that there has been a tendency to turn figures like Bach obviously Mozart, Beethoven, Brahms, are in that pantheon too, of deities, of something superhuman. The only way that anybody could have written music the way Bach did or the way Mozart did, you think of the movie Amadeus, is if they were divinely inspired, and kind of, something other than human. It isn't said explicitly in that movie that Wolfgang is not human, but there's the implication that, in that particular movie that God had made a choice, as though Wolfgang were Jesus, that he's a special form of human that's more than a human. He's also a god. And I think that we treat classical composers, and particularly, this sort of shrinking pantheon of special cases, as something more than human. And the problem with that, our world is very busy right now with all kinds of other dehumanization, in which we deem whole populations of people as something less than human and okay to exterminate or enslave or deport or relocate or dispossess or whatever, or just oppress. But to say somebody is more than human is also doing them a similar kind of disservice and sort of insult, because it's like, well, maybe Bach and Mozart wrote that good music because they tried really hard, not because they just lucked out and God, waved a magic wand and there was like some magic twinkle that just made them write the music automatically without any training or without any hard work, without any labor, without any self-management of time or moods or, all the things that come with composing music, So it's like, yeah, as long as we call Bach a god, then we don't have to marvel at, like, how could he churn out this much amazing music at such a fast clip? I mean, he was writing a new cantata every week, for years, at his main church gig, on top of writing all this other instrumental music just in his off hours, I mean, it's completely unbelievable. And you look at his manuscripts and there are no corrections, It's like he's able to, I mean, that's not God, that's talent, and that's work, and that's skill, and that's thought, and that's like not wasting your time on social media, and that's like devotion to craft. And it's like a, it's a lot of things that contributed to, yes, a human being just like you, just like me, being able to accomplish things that are hard to imagine ourselves accomplishing nowadays,
Yeah. It's funny too that you mentioned Amadeus, because when I was in college, I had a small part in a production of that, and
Sweet.
yeah, and I fell in love with the Requiem. And to this day, at least once a year I have to sit down and just listen to it, maybe twice in a row. And it was I was Before that, I was this kid that was listening to, heavy metal, and it was like nobody told me I had to love it. I just did.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
What can you say about that? I mean, sometimes it is helpful to have a sort of a bottle to put the music in, and Amadeus is a great example of that. It creates a context in which you can hear more than just notes and rhythms. And it's an irony of that plot is that Salieri, who's within the plot, he's the adversary, he's the heavy, he's the bad guy, he's the opponent, that you still sort of have sympathy for. Either that, or Mozart is the opponent and the bad guy, and you identify with Salieri. It's sort of up to the audience. But even being his adversary within the character structure, in fact, for the audience, he's the salesman for Mozart's music. he's the one who describes over and over and over in the movie describes how beautiful Mozart's music is, and he describes it in these incredible terms. You know, there's that there's that one piece for wind band that where he's talking to the chaplain, you know, in his little room at the asylum, and he's describing how it you know, the way it starts so simply, like a rusty squeeze box, and then the and then this you know, high above it all is you know, a single note, you know, hanging there. You know, he goes into this sort of florid detail, and really irresistible. What when you hear him describe it while the music is playing, he's like, he's a teacher. He's guiding you. He's teaching you how to appreciate music, which, like you said, I mean, I was also listening to heavy metal when the movie came out, and it's like, you know, it was cool to have that helping hand, and that's sort of one of the cool ironies or twists of the structure of that play and movie is that the opponent is the one who's actually selling the music to you, you know, against his own will, you know. It's very cool.
With this record, is kind of one of the hopes or maybe a something that if it happened you'd be really keen on, it would be that somebody would take this music and then they'd answer with their own interpretation of what you've done to kind of further the conversation.
A similar thought has occurred to me where people might just employ a similar process with other music from this or other eras that is not usually treated in this manner.
Totally. And I think that, you know, that could take all kinds of forms. I mean, the simplest version of that is Kurt has already, I mean, just last week he did a Bach Artillery concert with a different drummer. So already you have like an extension, you know, of what we did, but played, you know, with someone else. And in theory, I could do a Bach Artillery concert where I play the drums, but find someone else to play the keyboard parts. You know, I haven't
Absolutely.
Done that. Theoretically, that could happen. And you know, it's fun to sort of muse on the possibility that like a classical pianist who has Goldberg variations in their repertoire might hear our interpretation and they find themselves affected and influenced, and they might want to slightly alter the way that they're playing it now that they hear what obviously is our version, which is completely superior in every way. So,
yeah,
you know,
yeah, revolutionary.
All the on all the things that we did. I mean, totally. It's sort of like, Jed, what you were sort of getting at with the sort of communal music making. You know, and Bach is a great example, just because a lot of his music, Goldberg Variation is pretty hard, but
yeah,
a lot of his music is that hard to play. Like, I learned it as a piano student, just, you know, kid taking piano lessons. And, you know, he wrote certain pieces for that purpose. And that being the case, you know, it becomes something that you don't have to do years and years of like conservatory training just to be able to play a piece by Bach on a keyboard, you know?
Yeah.
And so that makes it fun. It's sort of like, this is just like one little step in like trying to take back, you could say, hobbyism or amateurism or collectivism or flexibility or kind of DIY, you know. I mean, Bach has been, like we said before, treated to so many kinds of reinterpretations and reinstrumentations over the decades. So it's not like his music hasn't already been redone a zillion ways, but I would say that one thing about ours is just that it's a little bit more punk. It's a little bit more loose. It's a little more sloppy. And you know, I think a lot of what ends up getting sort of reinterpreted Bach music is the kind of stuff that ends up on PBS special and it's like really super polite and it's very smooth. And I'm going to play on the guitar and put a didgeridoo in the background, or something to kind of smooth it out and try to make it quote unquote accessible to everybody. But you don't, that doesn't have to be the philosophy. His music could be interpreted in ways that make it less accessible, or make it more aggressive, or make it, less BS ready, and so yeah, it's just kind of like wanting to take that back, a little bit, the possibility that, like, no, we want to do it our way, whatever that is.
The time frame in which we are writing on the other side of, for instance, prog rock's
Totally.
fascination with classical music and Bach and other composers. And so we have that experiment to draw from and to take a different path from. And like you said, anything that's more polished in its reinterpretation.
Totally. Do you remember that on that one track we decided that we needed to do the whole piece like a Stonehenge from a Spinal Tap?
Right.
Yeah,
Yes.
we I was like, that was the one that we spent the most time on. I was like, Kurt, I don't think this introduction is working. Can we make it here? And then we went and found it on YouTube. We the in ancient times, the
Totally
druid.
worked.
All this kind of stuff, and the smoke machine and everything. And then that was what gave us it, that's how we figured out how to approach that particular canon, and it worked perfectly. It's exactly
Yeah.
what you just.
In retrospect, this conversation is making me wish that maybe we had left instructions to people who might want to do their own version. To say, start with the canons themselves. Here's the notation for the intros and outros. Here are the exact keyboards that I used and the settings that I used on. And then, you make your own soup out of this.
Maybe it's not too late. The album's not out till Friday. We can put in a bunch of insert,
Yeah, let's call Pete after this.
and
Urgent request.
yeah.
Well, that's what the internet is for, right? You just, for those who are really devoted, somehow you leak that there's that information someplace online, and
Yeah, that's a good point.
you
That's
can
what this interview is for.
That's right.
And then for the 10th anniversary edition, then.
Yeah. Love it.
You've been listening to a conversation with Greg Saunier and Kurt Sidner of Bach Artillery. Their self-titled debut album is out now via the Ernest Jennings Record Company. You can learn more about that release and the duo itself at bachartillery.bandcamp.com. You can learn more about this podcast and all programming on our station by visiting our website, kmuw.org. Send us your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org and find all the latest programming notes on that website as well. Thanks again for listening, and as always, we'd like to remind you that our theme music is composed and performed by Torrin Anderson.